Well, I don't know when it was the first time that I heard the term environmentalist in the political context, or when it was when I first learned that having a great respect and a great love for nature would push you more into the league of the liberal side of politics. You know, those godless atheists who worship the creation rather than the creator. There was a time when I think conservation of nature and mainstream Christianity coexisted more in harmony than it does today. You know, I grew up in the Lutheran Church, and honestly, apart from having to memorize the Ten Commandments and learning about the life of Jesus through the Gospels, you know, I don't remember a whole lot of what was taught in our Sunday school classes and in the worship service. And that's not a criticism on them. That's me. You know, as a child, I just don't remember a whole lot of what we learned there. But I do remember a great deal of what we learned in the Cub Scout organization that was sponsored by that church. You know, our local scout pack had weekly meetings that met inside the church building. And it was run by the deacons and the elders of the congregation. You know, they were leaders in the church. I don't know if we call them deacons or elders, but they were leaders in the church, and they managed and taught us little Cub Scouts. They taught us to love and respect nature out of the same mouth that they preached love and respect for God and Christ. And I don't recall there being any sort of political divisiveness over those two ideas. Now, that would be in the 1970s. Again, perhaps there was political division there, and I was just too young to see or understand it. All I knew was that loving the creation and loving the Creator were two concepts that went hand in hand. Well, as we begin to dissect this controversy of Creator worship versus creation worship, let's begin by establishing something that is firm and immovable. The truth stands on its own. It doesn't belong to any party system or political point of view. The truth is superior to all of those things. You know, it's the responsibility of those espousing their side as to whether their side is on the truth. You know, it's not the other way around. Truth is superior to philosophies and points of view, and it stands on its own. Let's turn over to Colossians chapter 2. Colossians, the second chapter, if you could turn over there. The question we have to ask is, are we willing to stand with the truth, even if it means that we come across maybe betraying our own cherished political beliefs, our own philosophical points of view? Let's start reading in verse 4 of Colossians chapter 2. Now this I say, lest anyone should deceive you with persuasive words. For though I am absent in the flesh, yet I am with you in spirit, rejoicing to see your good order and the steadfastness of your faith in Christ. As you therefore have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in him, rooted and built up in him and established in the faith, as you have been taught, abounding in it with thanksgiving. Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the traditions of men, according to the basic principles of this world, and not according to Christ. For in him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and you are complete in him, who is the head of all principality and power. And so the Greek word for philosophy there refers to any branch of knowledge, any branch of art or science. You know, those branches of knowledge we see, they come from the basic principles of the world, and they're the traditions of men, the conservative principles, the moderate principles, the centrist principles, the progressive principles, the liberal principles. And I'm not saying that those principles have no value whatsoever. I'm merely saying that they're inferior to the truth that comes with Christ. So where do you stand on conservation and the environment? Do you think you hold maybe a liberal or a conservative point of view? Or would you call it something else? Perhaps a biblical point of view. That would be nice. You know, what does the Bible say about nature and the environment? Well, we're going to discover today that the Bible has a lot to say about that subject. Some points we'll see might fall in line with one particular political point of view. It might lean a little to one side of the argument or the other. And then other points might lean more the other direction. And yet there are still other points of view that are outside of both of those ways of thinking. You know, they're above those points of view. It's the biblical point of view and the truth that is superior to all those other philosophies. If those in the various parties want to stand in the truth, they need to go to where the truth is and not expect the truth to come over and join them in their camp. And we all know the memory scripture. John 17:17 says, "Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth." The people of God are set apart. They're removed from the strictly liberal party, and they're removed from the strictly conservative party, and they're set apart for the truth party. And the foundational body of knowledge for the truth party is the word of God, his holy scriptures. So where does the truth find itself on the left versus right political graph regarding the environment? Well, let's begin by first establishing the parameters of the graph. We need to understand the extreme left border and the extreme right border in order to establish the boundaries. You know, on the extreme left side of environmentalism is the notion that there is no God. Life evolved on the planet from nothing. And for the godless, atheist environmentalist, well, life is a monumentally fantastic coincidence. You know, it's not something to be taken lightly, but to exalt and praise life itself as of the most supreme value. And the thought that one species would rise out of that to exercise dominion over the planet, but in so doing end up being destructive to the environment and to the planet. Well, what's that comparable to? Well, that's something like a disease or a parasite, right? That's the extreme left view of environmentalism. You know, mankind is a scourge on planet Earth, and it would be better off if that species wasn't even on the planet. That species known as humanity. Or at least the population needs to be drastically reduced. And by drastically, I think the ideal population size, according to secular humanism, is to be somewhere about 500 million. 500 million, you know. Now, I don't know how people espousing that view is going to get the human population from about 7 billion down to 500 million. How are they going to do that? How do they plan to achieve that goal? Well, we can start by championing some hotly debated political topics of our time, right? Abortion, same-sex marriage, transgenderism. You know, do you think it's a coincidence that these issues are some of what the liberal establishment has championed? Do you think it's solely about the freedom for people to just do whatever they want with their own bodies? Well, yes, I do think that is the liberal mindset. They do want to be left alone to do whatever they want, apart from biblical law. You know, that's for sure. But I strongly suspect that secular humanists who have as one of their primary goals to reduce the human population by up to 90%, well, I strongly suspect that they are supporting those political issues because it advances their agenda. Abortion and same-sex marriage and transgenderism directly result in the reduction of the human population. And I, for one, don't think that's a coincidence. But again, in the grand scheme of things, what difference would it make to the Earth and to the history of all life on the planet if this one species, you know, this human species, were to just vanish completely, just go away, just become extinct? That's a view that's held by the most extreme on the left side of environmentalism. Then there's the extreme on the right side of the environment, how we view the environment. Humans are, above all, free to do as they choose. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness determines that no government can tell anyone how they treat their own private property. You know, mankind was given dominion over the earth, and it's ours to use as we see fit. The environment is there to provide us with goods and resources. And the best way to go about accumulating those goods and those resources is by spending the least amount of money. That is extreme, unscrupulous capitalism. Retrieve the maximum yield while spending the smallest amount in investment. And that's called the profit margin. You know, I own my own business, so I understand the profit margin. On the one hand, I purchase supplies, I purchase fuel, I pay employees, I pay taxes. On the other hand, the customers pay me money for the services that we provide. And when I deduct the expenses from the gross sales, what I'm left with is the profit margin. Now, if you listen to conservative talk radio, you know, many of those talking heads or perhaps on the TV, those pundits on the TV, you know, many of them will deny that the free market can be so extremely unprincipled and unscrupulous. They'll tell you that it's to the free market investor's advantage to act responsibly, you know, so that the yield is greater for future generations. Yeah, well, you know, whoever said that people consistently do what is best for the long term and think about future generations going against what they could make as a quick buck? I'd like to share a personal story with you. I grew up about a half a mile away from a rather large river that flows out of the Pennsylvania mountains, and it goes down to empty into the Delaware River, which eventually empties near Philadelphia, and it flows into the Atlantic Ocean. And as kids, we spent a lot of time on the banks of that river, the Schuylkill River. Now, there were many ideal spots where you could cast a line and catch some fish. But there was one area where it was common knowledge that nobody would catch fish there. You simply didn't waste your time fishing that stretch of river. And there was a cement factory about 2 miles downstream from where I live, and it was located right on the bank of that river. And about where that factory sat, and then for a good mile or so downstream, well, it was understood by everyone that you simply didn't fish there. You weren't going to catch any fish there. There was no fish to be had. Or if they were there, they weren't eating. And that was all a great mystery to us as local kids. Well, it was a mystery until as a young man, I actually got a job at that cement factory. And I got to see firsthand what they dumped into that river. Let me give you just one example. There were these plastic molds that we used to fill with cement, and we would create a certain type of block. You know, a 90-pound block of cement would drop out of these molds, and over time, a cement residue would build up on these molds, and if they weren't cleaned, well, they'd start to actually tarnish the quality of the block that would come out. So consequently, these molds had to be cleaned occasionally. Now, the process for how these molds were cleaned is the purpose of the story that I'm sharing with you today. We had these large vats of acid that we kept just for the purpose of cleaning these molds. And don't ask me what kind of acid it was. All I know is that we had to wear something similar to hazmat gear when we were cursed with the responsibility of spending the day giving those molds the acid bath. We wore rubber suits. We had gloves up to the elbows. And even then, covered up like that, we did not come into direct contact with that acid. We used metal hooks to submerge the molds for a brief time, and then we would use those hooks to pull the molds back out. And the acid was so strong that over time, those metal hooks that we used would dissolve to nothing. We'd have to replace them over time because they'd simply shrink to nothing. But here's the shocking part. We would use those hooks, and we would throw the acid-drenched molds out onto the ground, and it was an area like a cement-covered parking lot. But there were a couple of drain gates in the cement pads. And we would use the water hose to rinse that strong acid off of the molds, and that acid would go directly into the drain. Now, where do you suppose those drains led to? Maybe some kind of treatment facility, perhaps? Maybe an advanced septic system? No. They were a direct line to the river. That strong acid that we had to wear hazmat gear to even be near, we dumped it directly into the river. I saw it with my own eyes. I participated in it. And that's just one example. You see, this factory was about making profit, maximizing profit. And it did so by producing cement blocks. And the least amount of money you spent doing that, the more there was for the profit margin. You know, why invest in some costly waste disposal system when we had this handy river flowing right by? That's a nice waste disposal system. Who's going to know the difference anyway? And who cares about those lousy fish? The whole ecosystem for nearly a mile down that river was directly affected by this practice, the practice of this one factory. Now, how many other factories were like that along the major rivers of the industrial United States? You know, all the rivers, all the rivers west of the Appalachians and east of the Rockies, they all flow into the Mississippi River. And where that river dumps into the Gulf of Mexico, there is a dead zone that is estimated to be the size of New Jersey. No life. You see, our dead zone in the Schuylkill River was about a mile long. We had a dead zone. It was a mile long. But by the time you get to the Gulf of Mexico, it's the size of New Jersey. Now, of course, as I mentioned, that river flows into the Delaware, which then flows into the Atlantic Ocean. It doesn't go to the Gulf of Mexico. But the point is that people making up industry and corporations, they can't be left without rules to abide by. They're always going to take the path of least resistance when the maximum amount of profit is yielded from the least amount of investment. That is the profit margin. And it is the central tenet of unprincipled capitalism towards the environment. You know, I've seen it with my own eyes. I know it's real. Now, some of you might balk at what I'm saying here, depending on your political views. But coming from someone who has directly worked in the great industrial centers of the Northeast, I can assure you that industry needs government regulation. That's just the way it is. But let's take a look at the biblical view now. You know, in quick summary, we could say that the extreme left view is that mankind is a scourge to the planet. Humanity is a disease and it needs to be purged from the environment. The extreme right view is that mankind owns the planet. We can do whatever we want with the planet. And it's all there to just provide us with goods and resources in the cheapest way possible. But what does the Bible say? Well, we need to start this discussion in Genesis chapter 1, of course. And let's turn over there, if you could. Genesis chapter 1. Here we'll find in a quick reading of verse 26 that the earth and its treasures are obviously there for mankind to use. And it's verses like these which so enrages the environmentalists. And it gives justification to the capitalist who's only working with a small range of biblical understanding, if there's biblical understanding there at all. But let's notice verse 26 of Genesis chapter 1. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And the word for dominion there is exactly what it says. It means exactly what it says. It means to rule over. It means to subjugate. It means to have dominion over. It's the same word that would be used when one nation conquers another nation, and that nation is put into subjugation under the other nation. But we know that doctrine is not established by one single verse, don't we? More comes to light when we combine other verses and we let them build one upon the other. You know, not contradicting each other, but building one upon another so that we can establish sound doctrine. Let's go over to chapter 2. And we'll build on this idea of man having dominion over the earth, to subjugate the earth and put it under our thumb, right? So Genesis chapter 2, let's read verse 15. Verse 15, "Then the eternal God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it." Ah, now we get a little more understanding of what God meant when he expected man to rule over the earth. You see, the words dominion and rule and subjugation, well, they have preconceived notions that come with them, don't they? They're based on mankind's misrule of each other and misrule of the planet after sin. But here we see the command to rule over the earth was given before the first sin was ever committed. Clearly, the word and the intent behind the word came before the misuse of the word. So let me repeat that again. The word dominion came before the misuse of the word. The intent of the word came before the misuse of the word. What we find here in chapter 2 and verse 15 are two more words that enrich our understanding of what dominion and rulership involve. Those two words are tend and keep. Tend here implies to dress it and to cultivate it, to improve upon it. And the word to keep here implies to guard over it and to protect it. Now, that's certainly the good kind of dominion, isn't it? Imagine if that's the only definition of the word dominion that we have. To have dominion over someone or something means to cultivate and to improve upon, to guard and protect. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 20. Matthew, the 20th chapter. You know, it's not that big of a stretch to imply that this is what is meant by the words dominion and rulership. And I mean dominion and rulership in all its forms. Dominion and rulership involve us to serve, to cultivate, to improve, to guard, and to protect. Notice what Jesus Christ instructs to his disciples regarding this subject here in Matthew chapter 20, and let's start reading in verse 25. Verse 25, "But Jesus called them to himself and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them.'" See, that's a phrase we like to use a lot, isn't it? Lord it over. That's where it comes from. The Gentiles do this. They lord it over each other. "And those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to be great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Rulership and dominion, by God's standards, are words that imply service. You know, the idea that rulership and dominion has to mean lorded over with subjugation, well, that's a Gentile definition. It's the ideas of men. It's the philosophies of this world. It's not the truth that is in Christ. So that concept stands outside of the current political debate, doesn't it? It's the biblical view, and it stands above the extreme left and above the extreme right. Mankind was given dominion over the earth and its resources to use. But that involves cultivating it, improving upon it, guarding it, and protecting it. And so what do we see when we examine just these two passages? Well, we learn that mankind was not a cosmic accident. He wasn't a random species that rose out of the universal gene pool as some kind of a parasite or a disease. God put mankind in the garden, and he placed him in charge. Everything there was for his use and for his benefit. But it only stands to reason then that if it was there for his use and for his benefit, and if he wants to maximize those benefits long term, well, then he would carefully manage it. He would cultivate it. He would watch over it. And he would guard and protect it. Do you need paper and lumber? Okay. Plant more trees, right? You know, this idea that we're harming the environment because we have a logging industry, because we need paper products, and that requires that we cut down trees. Well, that just doesn't stand up to logic. You know, trees are a renewable resource. Now, that doesn't mean it's not possible for the timber industry to mismanage forest lands. But, you know, you cut one down, you plant 10 in its place. It's pretty simple math. Do the scriptures talk about nurturing and caring for trees? Well, let's take a look at that. Turn over to Leviticus chapter 19, if you could. Leviticus, the 19th chapter. Here we'll see that that God gives specific instructions on how to manage fruit trees. The law of God, that old Mosaic law, has something to say about trees. Let's notice verse 23 of Leviticus 19. "When you come into the land and have planted all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as uncircumcised. 3 years it shall be uncircumcised to you. It shall not be eaten. But in the fourth year all its fruit shall be holy, a praise to the Eternal. And in the fifth year you may eat its fruit, that it may yield to you its increase. I am the Eternal your God." And then we can turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 20. We'll find some more specific instructions regarding trees. Deuteronomy, the 20th chapter. And these are just simply common sense passages that any casual reader can see the benefit of people, you know, wanting to do them by following these laws. Notice verse 19 of Deuteronomy chapter 20. "When you besiege a city for a long time while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them if you can eat of them. Do not cut them down to use in the siege, for the tree of the field is man's food. Only the trees which you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down to build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it is subdued." So trees can be used for man's purposes, but he's to do so with common sense and with care. Well, what about care and concern for other plant life? Let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Now, just a few chapters over in this written law, the written law of God, Deuteronomy chapter 22. Let's notice verse 9. Verse 9, "You shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seeds. lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard be defiled. Now, I don't know what you make of that verse, but it seems to me that God is telling us not to mess with the seeds, right? They're perfectly fine the way God created them. Now, is there something here for those monstrously large seed companies to consider with all their genetically modified foods? You know, I guess the truth of that passage places you firmly on one side of the issue, politically speaking, regarding the modification of seeds and allowing some crony capitalists to dominate the market with their junk products. I've heard some people speculate that there might be a correlation or a connection here with the sudden rise of gluten intolerance that we see emerging with these genetically modified foods. I talked about that recently in my last sermonette. And certainly the best way to get a handle on understanding a problem with humanity's ability to consume certain foods, well, it would be good to start out with the good, wholesome food that God created, that He designed from the beginning. And then we'll go from there and try to figure out what the problem is. But this wonderful plant kingdom, it's something that God created. It's His creation. He fashioned and designed every branch and every leaf. He ordained them to turn a certain color in the autumn. He placed their nuts and their fruits for all creatures to enjoy. He designed the flower petals, you know, the wonderful diversity that's in the flowers. You know, who can fathom such a grand design and artistry that went into the creation of flowers? Let's turn over to Luke chapter 12. Luke, the 12th chapter, you probably know the words of Jesus Christ that I'm going to quote here. We find a certain truth in the words of Jesus Christ regarding how God considers flowers. Notice this, verse 27. Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. The wealthiest man who ever lived, you know, decked with gold and silver, given servants and riches beyond measure. Everything that is valued by the traditions of men and the philosophies of this world. And yet God considers the single flower to be of much grander design. How much more so than if God has the ability to look down on the earth and see all the flowers blooming at once? Can you imagine having that ability? God can see every flower that is currently in bloom. God cares about His creation. And why wouldn't He? Who here would set about to create something and to successfully complete the project only to then consider it useless and unworthy of care? True followers of Christ who understand the laws of God do not disregard the environment as being unworthy of care. Let's go over to Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus, the 25th chapter. Here we'll see that God cares about how the land is managed. You know, we were given such a blessing here in North America with some of the most fertile lands on earth. Now, I've heard it said that in some of those Midwestern states like Iowa, my family and I lived in Iowa for a couple of years, but in some of those places, it was said that the topsoil was up to 14 feet deep. Just the topsoil. Unimaginably rich land that's just ready to burst forth into produce. Let's start reading right here in verse 1, Leviticus chapter 25. And the Eternal spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Eternal. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Eternal. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Whatever grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap, nor shall you gather the grapes of your untended vine, for it is a year of rest for the land." And then the chapter goes on to outline the rules and how the land Sabbath should work and how seven Sabbaths will take you down to the 50th year, the year of Jubilee. But let's drop down to verse 18. Leviticus 25 and verse 18. "So you shall observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them, and you shall dwell in the land in safety. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell there in safety." Now, this isn't some self-evident command that any dummy could figure out. You know, like the cutting down of, of food-bearing trees to conduct a siege. This was a complete act of faith. To let your land go fallow for a whole year, every 7 years, when people relied so heavily on agriculture for their survival. We rely heavily on agriculture for our survival. You may not realize, you think, well, you don't eat as many vegetables as you should, but most of the crops that are grown are fed to the animals that we eat. You know, so beef and chicken and eggs and all that stuff, it comes from our agriculture, our produce. 75% of what grows in farms is fed to animals. Let's drop down to verse 20. Or that's the next verse. We read verses 18 and 19, so let's read verse 20. And if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, since we shall not sow nor gather in our produce, then I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year, and it will bring forth produce enough for 3 years. And you shall sow in the eighth year and eat the old produce until the ninth year, until its produce comes in. You shall eat of the old harvest. You see, it was an act of faith. The people in ancient Israel had to have faith in order to obey God. So God gives provision for the land to rest, to rejuvenate so that the yield of its fruit will be greater in the long run. Not such a good plan for the short-sighted capitalist, but for our responsible steward of the land who considers the benefits for future generations. Well, the implications are obvious. That's the biblical view of land management. The land is there for mankind to use, not to be left for nature to take its course, as the environmentalists might imagine, but to get a good sustained yield from a responsible and caring steward. But what about animals? Certainly they're here for mankind to use, right? To rule over, to subjugate, to put our thumb on. Yes, but we've already seen that a good and wise ruler is one who cares for and serves those he rules. He cultivates and he protects. He upholds and he guards. And the Bible is clear that the shepherd is given charge to be a servant to the flock, to nurture it and to care for it. So much so that the analogy of the shepherd is used to describe the relationship that Jesus Christ has with his church. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 23. Exodus, the 23rd chapter. When we consider the law of God, what we're really doing is getting a glimpse into the mind of God. I want you to think about that for a minute. When you consider the law of God, you're getting a glimpse into the mind of God. We're seeing what kind of being God is, how he thinks, what he would do in this situation, what he would want us to do in this situation, what he would do in that situation. Let's notice this passage from the original Mount Sinai covenant that God established with Israel, Exodus chapter 23. And let's read in verse 19. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Eternal your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. You know, some laws you just have to step back and scratch your head and wonder, why have a law like this? You know, who would do such a thing? Who would boil a young infant animal in its own mother's milk? Well, apparently that's what the nations around them were doing. Now take note, this isn't a prohibition from you putting a slice of cheese on a slab of meat. This isn't a prohibition from combining meat and dairy products like we had to tolerate for so many years at the Jewish Community Center. This prohibition was regarding a pagan practice of boiling a young animal alive in its mother's milk. And from what I understand regarding this passage, the resulting liquid of that milk being boiled with its mother's own young, it created a powerful magical fertility potion, which it was sorcery and witchcraft, which they would then sprinkle on the fields, and that would induce the fields to yield its crop. It would cause a blessing to come on the land by the gods or goddesses of fertility, because they saw that you boiled a young animal in its mother's milk, so we're going to induce the land to be fertile. Who would worship such gods as this? Nasty and brutish gods that require the blood of the young at the hands of its mother before they would yield a crop. We don't worship a god like that. That requires such callous and despicable treatment of the creatures that he created. Let's notice a passage from Proverbs chapter 12. Proverbs, the 12th chapter. Notice the advice and wisdom Solomon was inspired to write concerning the treatment of animals. Now, just as a side note, as you're turning over there, Proverbs chapter 12, I've heard it said that if you were to take a tour of a modern meat processing slaughterhouse and you saw how animals are treated today before they wind up as meat in your supermarket, well, I'm somewhat certain you would not get to the end of that tour without vomiting or shedding some tears. You know, it was interesting this past week. My wife, Casey, asked me to watch a portion of a documentary with her. And I got two major facts out of that documentary that I'm using in my sermon today. And she had no idea what I was speaking about today. So I found that to be very inspiring. But the first fact was the one I shared earlier, that the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is the size of the state of New Jersey. See, I didn't know that until just a couple days ago. And I thought, I'm going to use that in my sermon. And then the second fact dealt with the horrific treatment of animals at these various food processing plants. And I'm not going to get into any specifics about it because we have a mixed audience today and I'm just not going to go there. But let's just say that this is not a place where you would take your fourth grade class to go on a field trip. You know, I can remember when my daughter was little, we had a homeschooling community and we toured a maple syrup processing plant. So we got to see how maple syrup was made. And that was a nice outing, a nice day. I'm pretty sure my son Matthew doesn't remember that. He might have been two or three at the time. But we saw how maple syrup was made. But you're not going to go and see how hamburger and chicken is made, trust me. Let's read Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 10. A righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. Yes, the tender mercies displayed by many of the Gentile nations surrounding the nation of Israel involved boiling a baby in its mother's milk and then using that as a magical potion to cause fertility in the land. Do you really want to know what the land needs to be fertile? What the land really needs to yield bumper crops year after year? Do you really need to perform witchcraft and sorcery to induce the land into fertility? What does the land need to consistently yield good crops? Well, you've already read it in Leviticus chapter 25, right there in verses 18 and 19. So you shall observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them. And then you will dwell in the land in safety. Then the land will yield its fruit and you will eat your fill and dwell there in safety. For the land to consistently yield a good and bountiful crop, it needs a people that are willing to keep God's laws in faith, to treat animals with kindness, to treat each other with mercy and kindness, to give the land a rest every 7 years, to even allow your beasts of burdens to have the weekly Sabbath rest. Let's turn over to Jeremiah chapter 12. Jeremiah, the 12th chapter. You know, these major prophets like Ezekiel and Isaiah and Jeremiah, they have a lot to say about how people treat this beautiful environment that God has given us as a heritage. Let's read verse 4 of Jeremiah chapter 12. How long will the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither? The beasts and birds are consumed for the wickedness of those who dwell there, because they said, he will not see our final end. You know, God's not going to see what's going on here. No one's going to know the difference. Who cares if we dump a little acid into the river? Who cares about a little pollution here and there? The earth is resilient. It's going to recover. Let's drop down to verse 10. Verse 10, many rulers have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. They have made it desolate. Desolate. It mourns to me. The whole land is made desolate, because no one takes it to heart. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 11. We're wrapping it up here. Revelation chapter 11. You know, maybe all these curses and warnings that come from the prophets and the law, well, that was just for the ancient Israelites, right? That was Old Testament times. Certainly the New Testament isn't so harsh in the judgment on people and how they treat the earth. Let's notice Revelation chapter 11 and verse 18. Verse 18, the nations were angry and your wrath has come, and the time of the dead that they should be judged, and that you should reward your servants, the prophets and the saints, and those who fear your name, small and great, and should destroy those who destroy the earth. Well, I think that's sufficient to demonstrate what the Bible says about how man should treat the environment. Mankind is the pinnacle of God's creation. He's not some accident that the environment churned out like some disease or parasite. And this creation was put by God under man's authority. Certainly the bounty is there for us to use and to enjoy, only to be used wisely and cared for and nurtured and guarded over and protected. Let's look at one final passage in Romans chapter 8, if you could turn over there. Romans chapter 8 is my favorite chapter in the Bible, I think. I like to quote here a lot, but does God care about his creation? Should the children of God care about his creation? Well, let's close with a passage from Romans chapter 8, verse 19. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. That's you and me, the children of God. We're going to be a blessing for God's creation. We will be glorious liberty for God's creation because God loves his creation.